Greetings, and welcome to the Crinetics Pharmaceuticals conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, August 10th, 2021. I would now like to turn the conference over to Corey Davis, LifeSci Advisors. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator, and thanks to everyone for participating in today's call. Before we start, I'd like to point out there is a slide deck that's going to accompany today's presentation. The deck can be viewed using the webcast link that's on the IR section of the Crinetics website, and you can download a copy of the slide deck as well. Also posted on that same IR website is a news release issued earlier today announcing data from the Phase 1 single ascending dose study evaluating CRN-4894. A press release announcing the company's financial results for the quarter ended June 30, 2021 is also available on the company's website, though that is not the focus of today's call. Before handing it off to Crinetics to talk about their newly announced data, I'd like to remind everyone listening that some of the information contained in the news release and on this call is covered under the Safe Harbor provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act and contains forward-looking statements based on current expectations, including statements about the initiation of planned clinical trials. Such forward-looking statements are not a guarantee of performance, and the company's actual results could differ materially from those stated or implied in such statements due to the risks and uncertainties associated with the company's business. These forward-looking statements are qualified in their entirety by the cautionary statements contained in the company's other news releases and Crinetics SEC filings, including its annual report on Form 10-K. I'd also like to point out that the content of this call contains time-sensitive information that is accurate only as of the date of this live broadcast, August 10, 2021. Crinetics takes no obligation to revise or update any forward-looking statements to reflect events or circumstances after the date of this conference call. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Scott Struthers, founder and CEO of Crinetics. Scott, over to you.
Thanks, Corey, and thanks to all of you listening this afternoon. I'm joined today by Dr. Alan Krasner, our Chief Medical Officer. Mark Wilson, our Chief Financial Officer, will also be available to answer questions following our prepared remarks. As Corey mentioned, the purpose of today's call is to discuss results of our Phase 1 single ascending dose study evaluating the safety, pharmacokinetics, and pharmacology of CRN-04894, our oral non-peptide ACTH antagonist that is being developed for Cushing's disease and congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Let me cut to the chase. We are all very excited to let you know that CRN-4894 has demonstrated pharmacologic proof of concept and good drug-like properties in the SAD portion of our first-in-human healthy volunteer Phase 1 study. Pharmacokinetic analysis showed that 4894 was orally bioavailable with dose proportional exposure and favorable half-life of about 24 hours. 4894 was also well tolerated at single doses up to 80 milligrams. We saw no serious SAEs in the SAD study, and all reported adverse events were mild. Finally, our pharmacologic analysis showed strong dose-dependent suppression of both basal cortisol and ACTH-induced cortisol. Further, 4894 treatment resulted in clinically meaningful cortisol suppression, as study participants treated with 4894 maintained their normal cortisol levels in the face of a disease-relevant ACTH challenge. Collectively, we believe these clinical findings provide pharmacologic proof of concept for 4894 in Cushing's disease, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and any other disease driven by excess ACTH. We look forward to building on them with data from our multiple ascending dose study, which are expected in the fourth quarter. That being said, I'd like to put these results in context by first giving a high-level overview of our drug development strategy, 4894's mechanism of action, and its potential role in the treatment of diseases of ACTH excess. Then Alan will go through the details of the study results and our conclusions. Those of you who have followed our company for some time now know that the beauty of endocrinology drug development is the ability to follow and utilize endocrine biomarkers from preclinical studies to healthy volunteers to patients. We saw good hormonal suppression in the first-in-human pharmacologic proof-of-concept study for paltusotine, and now it's in Phase 3 registrational studies. And now we have successfully applied this development strategy to 4894. While I realize that you don't typically see history slides in a presentation like this, with today's results, I believe it's justified. This is a picture of Harvey Cushing. He's a giant in the field of endocrinology and a father of neurosurgery. His index patient for Cushing's disease was first visited him in 1910, so the field of ACTH is now more than 110 years old. There are more than 60,000 papers discussing ACTH in the scientific literature. Today, Alan and I will be presenting initial clinical studies from the first ever ACTH antagonist to be evaluated in humans. This is a significant milestone for the field of endocrinology, and especially for Crinetics, as we have now clinically demonstrated pharmacologic proof of concept for our second internally discovered drug candidate. The hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis is the body's emergency response system for stress. To provide a simplified explanation of the way this axis works, inputs from the environment or the body indicating the presence of stress, say for example, a lion chasing you across the savanna, will converge on the pituitary gland to stimulate the secretion of ACTH through a variety of different mechanisms, most prominently via peptide hormones, CRF and AVP. ACTH, however, only has one job, which is to bind to the specific receptor, the MC2-MRAP complex, on the adrenal gland. This results in activation of pathways leading to cortisol synthesis and secretion. Cortisol will then act on peripheral target tissues throughout the body via glucocorticoid receptors, regulating a wide range of physiologic adaptations to stress. Cortisol also provides important negative feedback to shut off ACTH secretion to prevent excessive responses to stress. Because the upstream pathways activating the stress response all converge on the ACTH receptor in the adrenal, we believe this represents the best point of the HPA axis to target in order to effectively counteract the effects of excess ACTH, as blocking it can inhibit everything else happening downstream. Turning our attention to slide 10, you can see that the cortisol levels in healthy subjects follow a diurnal cycle with higher levels in the early morning and lowest levels late at night. However, if excess ACTH is consistently present, as is in the case for Cushing's disease patients, cortisol levels will be both elevated and remain relatively constant throughout the day. This unremitting excessive endocrine stress response leads to symptoms such as weight gain, hypertension, hyperglycemia, and psychiatric disorders. In fact, the causative link between excess ACTH and elevated cortisol levels in Cushing's disease is so well established that cortisol levels are used as the registrational endpoint for trials in Cushing's disease treatments. The hypothesis that forms the basis of our 4894 program is that an oral and selective ACTH antagonist would have utility in treating not only Cushing's disease, but in treating any disease of ACTH excess, including congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH. Looking at the middle portion of the slide, you'll see the pathophysiology of Cushing's disease, where an ACTH-secreting pituitary adenoma, which is not the subject of negative feedback loop I mentioned earlier, results in elevated ACTH levels and overstimulation of the adrenal gland. This causes excess cortisol production, resulting in the symptoms I discussed on the previous slide. CAH is another example of a disease of ACTH excess. CAH patients have an inactivating mutation in the enzyme that is required for the final step of synthesis of cortisol. As you can see in the right-hand column, this lack of cortisol production breaks the negative feedback loop, leading to overproduction of ACTH and therefore excess stimulation of the adrenal. However, although the adrenal is activated, the lack of necessary enzyme for conversion of precursors into cortisol results in the accumulation of these precursors, which are androgenic. The loss of cortisol and production of excess androgens results in symptoms such as adrenal insufficiency, infertility, testicular arrest tumors, short stature, hirsutism, and other issues. 4894 is designed to prevent the overproduction of both cortisol and its adrenergic precursors by inhibiting the actions of ACTH on the ACTH receptor, which represents a single choke point that controls all downstream ACTH-induced signaling in the adrenal. Now, in the healthy volunteer study we'll be talking about today, we assessed 4894's ability to inhibit this receptor by measuring changes in cortisol levels before and after challenging healthy volunteers with synthetic ACTH. While this protocol briefly mimics Cushing's disease, it's important to remember that cortisol levels are a surrogate for adrenal stimulation. This means that the results from this study and 4894 in general are broadly applicable not only to Cushing's disease, but any disease driven by ACTH excess. Other drugs that are currently available or in development take one of three major approaches to counteract the effects of ACTH, excess ACTH. One of these three approaches is to target the pituitary gland to prevent ACTH secretion. Examples of agents that seek to do this are glucocorticoids for CAH, pasireotide for Cushing's disease, which are in use, and CRF antagonists, which are in development. A second approach is to act at the adrenal gland to inhibit the enzymes responsible for synthesizing cortisol and other adrenal hormones. This class of agents is often referred to as adrenal steroidogenesis inhibitors, with notable drugs in the class being ketoconazole, metoprolol, and oseltamivir, while the agent levoketoconazole is in development. Finally, there are glucocorticoid receptor antagonists which seek to counteract the effects of elevated cortisol by acting on the peripheral target cells. An example of an available drug in this class is mifepristone, while the agent relacorilant is in development. Now, despite there being FDA-approved drugs in each of these three classes, and talking to thought leaders in our field, we realize that a very significant unmet medical need still exists for patients with diseases of ACTH excess. It's because each of these drugs have shortcomings related to their safety and or limiting efficacy, resulting in an unfavorable risk-benefit profile for many patients. To fill this need, several years ago, we launched an internal drug discovery effort to create orally available non-peptide ACTH antagonists. We did this because we believe that any new drug in one of the three currently available classes would have similar shortcomings and thus not solve the core issue that currently hampers the treatment of patients with diseases of ACTH excess. As mentioned above, the ACTH receptor represents a single and selective choke point through which we can potentially counteract the effects of excess ACTH, which makes it a compelling drug target. Like all our drug candidates, 4894 was crafted by our in-house discovery group with the goal of incorporating optimal pharmacologic and pharmaceutical properties, including oral bioavailability and other drug-like properties. Was designed to potently and selectively inhibit the action of ACTH on the adrenal gland by competing for a common binding site. The balance of 4894 or ACTH occupancy of this binding site is determined by the relative affinities and concentrations of the two molecules, a concept known as competitive antagonism that we evaluated as part of the SAD study we're discussing today. Following our overall endocrine development strategy after designing 4894, we then tested its ability to block the action of ACTH in rats. As you can see on the graph on the right side of this slide, 4894 was able to suppress adrenal activity in a dose-dependent fashion, both in a basal state and after challenge with exogenous ACTH. We anticipated observing similar in vivo pharmacology in healthy volunteers, and after appropriate manufacturing and first-in-human enabling toxicology studies, we launched a phase one healthy volunteer study to test this. Those results I'll ask our Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Alan Krasner, to present. Alan?
Thank you, Scott, and good afternoon, everyone. Our phase one single ascending dose study was designed to assess safety, tolerability, pharmacokinetics, and the pharmacologic effects of single doses of CRN4894 on healthy volunteers. We evaluated four different 4894 dose levels in the study, 10, 20, 40, and 80 milligrams, escalating the doses sequentially after a safety review of the previous cohort. By doing this, we were able to assess safety, tolerability, and PK in healthy volunteers as is standard practice in first-in-human studies. Now, as Scott alluded to earlier, what is unique about this single-dose study is that it was also designed to establish pharmacologic proof of concept for 4894. In order to establish proof of concept, we evaluated 4894's ability to block the action of ACTH on the adrenal gland, which should be predictive of the molecule's efficacy. To make this assessment, We measured levels of cortisol in the blood before and after administration of synthetic ACTH to healthy volunteers in the presence and absence of 4894. The ACTH challenge is based on a well-established technique to assess adrenal function that has been used by endocrinologists for many years. Now, if I can turn your attention to the diagram on the right side of the slide, I'll briefly explain how we have adapted this technique to explore the pharmacology of 4894. On day minus one, we took blood draws to establish baseline cortisol values, administered synthetic ACTH, and then took blood draws at various times to see how cortisol levels respond to the ACTH challenge. The next day, we treated study participants with oral 4894 or placebo, took measurements to see the effect of 4894 on basal cortisol levels, then repeated the ACTH challenge, and again measured blood cortisol to determine how 4894 affects the adrenal response. You may have noticed on this slide that we performed the challenge assay using two different doses of ACTH, 250 micrograms and 1 microgram. We did this because we hope to accomplish two distinct goals with our pharmacodynamic analyses. First, we wanted to show that we could achieve dose-dependent suppression of both basal cortisol and of cortisol secretion following maximal stimulation of the adrenal gland with ACTH. Second, we hope to show that we could achieve clinically meaningful levels of cortisol suppression following a disease-relevant ACTH challenge. This would provide pharmacologic proof of concept for 4894 and would help de-risk demonstration of efficacy in subsequent clinical trials in patients. Now, because 4894 works via competitive inhibition, the 250 microgram challenge was best suited to evaluate dose-dependent pharmacology, and the 1 microgram assay was employed to provide evidence of a clinically meaningful level of suppression. That's because a 250 microgram challenge is known to result in ACTH exposures that are orders of magnitude greater than what would be seen in congenital adrenal hyperplasia or Cushing's disease patients. Having these suprapathophysiologic levels of ACTH present provides an extremely robust assay for dose response studies, as 4894 will be competing with enough ACTH to achieve full target receptor occupancy. It was for this reason, as well as the fact that this assay is familiar to endocrinologists, that we utilized it, along with measuring basal cortisol levels, to determine the dose-dependent pharmacological effects of 4894. In order to generate evidence of 4894's ability to achieve clinically meaningful levels of cortisol suppression, we utilized the 1 microgram ACTH challenge. Injection of 1 microgram of ACTH briefly results in a suprapathophysiologic ACTH peak that promptly falls to levels seen in CAH and Cushing's disease patients, making this assay more relevant to disease states compared to the 250 microgram assay. Moving on now to discuss the data. I'd first like to again emphasize that to date, the study drug has been well tolerated with no serious adverse events and only mild AEs observed. Our pharmacokinetic analyses showed that 4894 had favorable pharmaceutical properties, as it demonstrated oral bioavailability with dose proportional exposure, a half-life of approximately 24 hours, and a time to maximal concentration of approximately 1 hour. We are now collecting additional PK data in the multiple ascending dose portion of the study, which together with these data will inform our future study design and dosing strategy. Shifting focus now to our pharmacodynamic analyses, let's first look at the effects of 4894 on basal cortisol levels. These levels are measured prior to ACTH challenge. As you can see from the graph on the slide, 4894 administration resulted in rapid and dose-dependent reductions in basal cortisol levels in healthy volunteers. One important aspect to note is that at 80 milligrams, we saw a reduction near the theoretical maximum. This theoretical maximum is based on how long it would take existing cortisol in the blood to be degraded, assuming 4894 prevented the production of all new cortisol upon its administration. On slide 14, you can see that 4894 was able to inhibit adrenal secretion of cortisol following challenge with 250 micrograms of ACTH, which, as I mentioned, is a suprapathophysiologic challenge that is known to result in ACTH exposures that are orders of magnitude higher than those seen in Cushing's disease or CAH patients. On the left-hand side of the slide, you can see the full-time course of suppression. For clarity, we are only showing the data for the 80 milligram dose in this graph, but the shapes of the curves were similar for all doses tested. On the right, you can see that when evaluating the area under the cortisol curves for each dose, we see an effect that is dose dependent, with 80 milligrams of 4894 resulting in a 41% reduction in ACTH-induced cortisol. When considering the rigor of this assay, which involves maximally stimulating the adrenal gland, this result is impressive. Turning our attention to slide 15, we can see how 4894 performed in response to the 1 microgram ACTH challenge. The success of the 250 microgram ACTH challenge allowed us to focus on the 80 milligram dose when we evaluated 4894 using the disease-relevant 1 microgram ACTH challenge. Focusing first on the baseline curve, which was taken on day minus 1 when no 4894 was administered, you can see that the healthy volunteers saw their plasma cortisol level spike above 18 micrograms per deciliter in response to a 1 microgram ACTH challenge, well above their normal baseline and mimicking a transient Cushing's disease-like state. If we compare these data to the data taken from the same subjects after 4894 was administered on day 1, you can see that we were able to achieve meaningful cortisol suppression as the study participants maintained their normal cortisol levels in the face of the disease-relevant ACTH challenge, which is exactly what we hope to see. In fact, if we look at the 30-minute time point, which is when cortisol levels peaked in response to the ACTH challenge in the absence of 4894, you can see that the measured cortisol levels on drug are virtually unchanged from the cortisol levels observed in these subjects prior to the administration of 4894 or ACTH. This also is an impressive result that clearly demonstrates pharmacologic proof of concept for 4894, and I look forward to the continued clinical evaluation of the molecule. Now, before I hand it back to Scott to make some concluding remarks, I just wanted to sum up the key conclusions from our single ascending dose data and speak a bit about where 4894 could fit into the therapeutic armamentarium for diseases of ACTH excess. With regard to the data, single doses of 4894 up to 80 milligrams were generally safe and well tolerated, as we saw no serious adverse events, and all reported adverse events were mild. Our pharmacokinetic analyses showed that we achieved our target PK profile. 4894 was rapidly absorbed following oral administration with a Tmax of about 1 hour, dose proportional exposure, and a favorable half-life of about 24 hours. And finally, we clinically established pharmacologic proof of concept by demonstrating the activity of 4894 in healthy volunteers. We were able to achieve strong dose-dependent suppression of both basal and ACTH-induced cortisol, even when anticipated levels of ACTH exposure were orders of magnitude higher than those seen in disease state. Further, we showed that 4894 treatment resulted in clinically meaningful cortisol suppression as study participants treated with 4894 maintained their normal cortisol levels in the face of disease-relevant ACTH challenge. With these data, we believe we have taken a major step toward introducing a new drug class for patients with ACTH-driven diseases. These data show that 4894 is acting as an ACTH antagonist, which clearly differentiates the molecule from other agents that are currently used, approved, or in development. Importantly, we believe this unique mechanism of action, which is highly specific for the target receptor, positions 4894 to overcome the shortcomings associated with competing assets. Looking ahead, we are currently in the process of conducting the multiple ascending dose portion of our 4894 Phase 1 study. We expect the multiple dose data to further demonstrate 4894's pharmacologic effects, provide additional insights into the therapeutically relevant doses, and inform the design of subsequent trials. We plan to report these data in the fourth quarter. With that, I'll now hand the call back over to Scott.
Thanks, Alan. Before we move on to Q&A, I just wanted to quickly mention next steps and some of the milestones we are looking forward to later this year across our pipeline, which now includes two candidates beyond pharmacologic proof of concept. With regard to the 4894 program, our next step is to complete our MAD study to inform subsequent trials that seek to further develop the molecule as a treatment for Cushing's disease and CAH, which collectively affect about 37,000 patients in the United States. Our results today have established pharmacologic proof of concept for both these diseases, and we look forward to the program's continued advancement. In addition to reporting data from this MAD study in the fourth quarter, we also expect to achieve several milestones outside our 4894 program between now and year end. As you can see on this slide, the first of these milestones will be the reporting of similar SAD data for our phase one trial evaluating CRN04777, which is an oral non-peptide SST5 agonist being developed for the treatment of congenital hyperinsulinism. This program also follows the endocrine drug development blueprint we utilized for both paltusotine and have now further validated with 4894. This phase one trial for 477 is designed to generate proof of concept data in healthy volunteers by assessing the ability of the molecule to inhibit insulin secretion and elevate blood glucose levels in different provocation paradigms. We anticipate these results to be predictive of efficacy in patients and, if positive, allow for early de-risking of the program. We expect to announce the single ascending dose data in September. In addition to this study, we also expect to initiate our phase 3 Pathfinder 2 acromegaly trial and a phase 2 trial evaluating paltusotine in patients with carcinoid syndrome in the second half of the year. Collectively, we expect the execution of these clinical milestones to further solidify our leadership position in the field of endocrinology. We look forward to the continued advancement of our programs and remain committed to working to improve the lives of our patients. I'm extremely proud of the Crinetics drug hunters and drug developers who have brought us to this important milestone in our history, but also of all the Crineticans who have been building and supporting a company that continues to innovate new therapeutics and bring them closer to more patients each day. I'm also grateful to the investigators and participants in our clinical studies that are so critical to the success of clinical development of new drug candidates. With that, I'd like to thank everyone for joining our call and open it up to questions. Operator?
Thank you. If you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. One moment, please, for the first question. Our first question comes from the line of Charles Duncan with Cantor Fitzgerald. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, hi, Scott and team. Thanks for taking our question and congratulations on these early results. So I had a couple of questions. First of all, could you give a little bit more detail? Were these normal human volunteers, were they tested on a fed or fasted state? And then regarding call it maximal tolerated dose, I guess you'll need to establish that in multiple ascending dose studies.
Ellen, do you want to take that, please?
Yeah. Hey, Chaz. So these patients are all fasting, as you would normally do in a first-in-human. We are not evaluating any food effect at this point. That would come later. It's not an important issue for this patient population. The second question, Chaz, again?
Yeah, regarding maximal tolerated dose.
That's not a specific. Yeah, I would say this. That's not a specific objective of the SAD. We certainly have been well tolerated to date. We do have to establish, as you mentioned, safety in the multiple dosing section of the study, which is ongoing.
And then with regard to the tox testing that you've done with this, what is the length of coverage that you have? How long could you pursue, dosing over time?
Well, as with any program, Chaz, the tox coverage continues to increase. We initiated these with 1 month of tox coverage in rats and dogs, and we have additional toxicology studies ongoing now to support longer-term studies in phase two.
Okay, last question is, you mentioned the positioning of this mechanism relative to, say, CRF antagonists or cortisol receptor modulators. I guess I'm wondering if you think that for either Cushing's or CAH patients, if this particular mechanism has a potential better utility than some of the others, and what its advantage is.
Well, we have a lot to learn still about ACTH antagonists. This is just SAD data, very encouraging SAD data. But from a theoretical perspective, I think it all comes down to ACTH, its professional single job is to stimulate the adrenal gland. And so all the signaling that may occur from various stressors, whether it's psychological or hemorrhage or whatever is causing the stress, converges on the ACTH receptor. And by blocking that, we block at the single choke point of the HPA axis. And so I think that offers a kind of a unique angle compared to any other type of target. I mean, as you know, CRF is a wonderfully interesting peptide. I was in the lab that my PhD advisor discovered it. And it has some remarkable CNS activities and activities throughout the gut and activities at the pituitary to stimulate the secretion of ACTH. But the only real professional HPA axis player is ACTH and then later glucocorticoids. But, of course, glucocorticoids have broad-spectrum activities throughout the body. So I think that's the main thing, is the specificity of the underlying biological mechanism.
Okay, that's helpful. Look forward to additional data later on this year with this program. Congrats.
Thanks very much, Charles.
Our next question comes from the line of Joseph Schwartz with SVB Leerink. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks very much. Congratulations, Scott, and all the Prin netizens. It's a pretty exciting milestone
Thanks,
for the field. So I was wondering, you mentioned that cortisol levels are considered a valid surrogate endpoint for approval of medicines for patients with Cushing's. So I was wondering, how should we think about the plasma cortisol reductions that you're reporting here in the context of urinary free cortisol, which I think is the metric that's used for approval? Do they move together in a predictable fashion, or are there any heuristics that we should keep in mind in order to try to envision how this data might progress at later stages of development?
Yeah, no, great question, Joe. Alan, do you want to give some context there?
Sure.
On why physicians use urinary instead of plasma for registrational endpoints?
Absolutely. So you're right that urine-free cortisol, which is a measure of integrated cortisol exposure over the course of an entire 24 hours, is a common tool used to diagnose Cushing's syndrome in clinical medicine, and it's also used as sort of the registrational endpoint by FDA and other regulatory agencies for approval of new drugs for Cushing's disease. If you ask me how do these data that we are presenting sort of predict what would happen with continuous dosing to UFC over time, I mean, I would expect it to be lowered, especially if you look at our disease-relevant ACTH challenge test, the 1 microgram test, and you can see that the overall exposure to cortisol in the setting of a relevant ACTH exposures is clearly lower, even with a single dose. So I would predict with time we would see this integrated measure of cortisol, overall cortisol exposure drop with time as well.
Makes sense. Thanks for that explanation. Maybe as a follow-up to that, How are you thinking about the dosing schedule that would be most appropriate for 4894, given what we know about the diurnal rhythm of cortisol synthesis? How do you feel about the ability for 4894 to be administered in a manner that could accomplish a natural, a mimicking of the natural diurnal rhythm that we all probably take for granted?
Fado.
Well, that's a great question. It's something that could determine and is used sometimes in clinical medicine, the timing of dosing with respect to the target, the disease or condition you're trying to treat. I would start out by saying that based on our PK profile, we have flexibility there. We could be a once-a-day drug. The timing of that dose could, though, be dependent on what we're targeting. So we do have this early morning surge in ACTH, and in some situations I could see we might want to sort of target the dose relative to timing. But I think we have a lot of flexibility with this PK profile. We may not need to have an unusual or a dose timing that is different than any other medication. This is exactly one of the many questions we hope to explore with the multiple dose data and clinical trials in patients in particular.
Great. Thanks for taking my question.
Thanks, Joe.
Our next question comes from the line of Jessica Fye with JP Morgan. Please proceed with your question.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my questions. So I've got a few. First, based on what you've learned from the single ascending dose portion, what doses or what dose range are you expecting to study in the multiple ascending dose portion? And just thinking out loud, given that presumably you'll want to see activity once the drug reaches steady state, can you explain the design a little bit more? Will you do ACTH challenges in that portion of the trial at a certain time point? And if so, what time point? And then I've got a couple others.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. Alan, why don't you respond?
Yeah. So we are in the multiple dose trial. We are dosing on a daily basis. We are evaluating a variety of pharmacodynamic measures and do plan to assess the timing of dosing as part of one of the variables to explore in that part of the trial. Again, that's more relevant in the patients, which we hope to get to someday. I think that it will be important to help refine the doses that we use in patients someday. As far as the specific doses we would use in IMAD, of course, that would be lower than we would start with lower doses than we've explored in SAD as is routine, and then escalate in an ascending cohort pattern after we've established safety at each dose.
And ACTH challenge?
ACTH challenge, yes, will be evaluated as well.
Okay, and how do you think about the possible risk of adrenal insufficiency in the healthy volunteers in the multiple ascending dose portion? And last one, should we think of this product as ultimately being titrated when it's used in the real world in patients?
With regard to safety in the multiple ascending dose, yes, that's a primary, it is the primary responsibility of the study design and the study staff who monitors these patients. These patients would be getting daily doses for 10 days in the MAD. There's a lot of detail in the protocol about assessing for the onset of clinical adrenal insufficiency. And if that should occur in a metabolic unit, of course, it would be straightforward to rapidly attend to. These data will give us information that would be valuable to predict the risk of adrenal insufficiency in patients, and certainly, ultimately, our outpatient phase 2 and phase 3 studies will have appropriate precautions and safety precautions for patients in those trials. Whether this is a drug that would be titrated, dose adjusted, I think that remains to be seen. We have to learn more about the dose response, not only in healthy volunteers, but in patients. Let me reserve judgment on that for now.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Jess.
Our next question comes from the line of Douglas Tsao with H.C. Wainwright. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the questions. Just maybe, Scott, just be curious from your perspective, just given what you think that this is a more relevant mechanism for CAH and Cushing's, just curious, how do you expect this to manifest in terms of better outcomes and efficacy in patients? Do you expect to see sort of, faster onset of symptom relief, or, just curious in your perspective and how we should see this profile emerge?
Well, I guess the way we think about it is, as we've shown in our preclinical program, the ACTH antagonism can block the adrenal activation, both that results in excess ACTH, that equivalently would result in excess androgens in the case of where ACTH can't be converted from the androgens. And we've shown a reduction in ACTH-stimulated hyperplasia of adrenal glands in rats. And so I think this suggests the possibility for a very broad dynamic range in a clinical setting. And we really need to get into the patient studies to fully explore that. But if you compare that to some of the other mechanisms, as I mentioned, the pituitary-targeted agents, the pituitary integrates lots of different things to decide how much ACTH to make. And in the case of Cushing's disease, it's a tumor that really doesn't care about inputs. It just makes a lot of ACTH. So those pituitary-related mechanisms don't do very well for Cushing's and only can address part of the ACTH secretion in CAH. And then similarly, the downstream ones, the glucocorticoid receptor pathway is involved in so many different things you have to be very careful there, but I think more importantly, from a physician point of view, you can't measure biochemically the effect of your drug, and so it becomes a little bit difficult to choose doses. In the case of an ACTH receptor, you're simply measuring either ACTH receptor antagonist, you're simply measuring either cortisol in, say, a Cushing's patient or adrenal androgens in a CAH patient. So I think there's kind of a fundamental ease of use question that's available there. And Alan, maybe you want to comment on the steroidogenesis inhibitors, since you know a little bit more about that than I do.
Right. So the main members of that class have been around for a long time, particularly ketoconazole and metirapone. And they are effective at lowering cortisol with repeated treatment, but there's a lot of challenges with titrating those drugs to fully effective doses. It's difficult to achieve fully effective doses without some degree of toxicity or lack of toleration in this class. So when you look, do patients stay on these drugs for long periods of time? The answer is no. There's pretty low adherence rates with drugs, for example, ketoconazole. So clearly there's a need for new options, probably a new mechanism of action like this.
Okay, great. That's really helpful. And I'm just curious, when you think about moving into clinical studies, phase 2 and phase 3, would you anticipate having studies that are similar to what, has been done with the other mechanisms, or do you anticipate being sort of somewhat novel and taking advantages of some of the nature of your drug? Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate the questions. You know, I'm a big fan of novelty and creativity, especially in early clinical development and discovery. But those are less important when it comes to registrational studies, and we will talk to the FDA and other regulators, figure out what precedents are important to them, and then satisfy those precedents and those requirements, and to the extent we can, design elements to the study, which then on top of that core registrational need can provide information that might highlight the benefits of this mechanism. So, you know, I think we'll listen very carefully to the regulators and try and get this drug out on the market as streamlined as possible.
Okay, great. That's it for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Doug.
Our next question comes from the line of Catherine Novak with JonesTrading. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my questions. Just have a few. First, you know, can you talk about potential plans to share these data? Do you think we'll see full data from the SAD? And then with regard to the MAD, are there additional biomarkers that you plan to look at to kind of give us a better idea of the profile of the drug and its activity?
Yes, thanks, Catherine. Well, there's not a lot of big endocrine meetings in the fall, so the most likely might be the Endocrine Society meeting in the spring, which is a watershed for endocrinology around the world. But if we can find some other good venues to talk on, we'll certainly do so. In terms of other biomarkers, I think that, you know, we'll measure a bunch of different things, but cortisol and drug levels are really at the root of what we need to understand. So that other information will come out in the scientific publications and scientific presentations to the extent that it's relevant.
Okay. Thanks. And then just in terms of Cushing's disease, I had kind of curious about how you see this profile in terms of, you know, other existing approved drugs that may have had relatively high response rates but might be inconvenient or otherwise, you know, not desirable, that it might be driving lower compliance rates in treatment.
Well, maybe you can comment on that, Alan, since you're the one who's practiced clinical endocrinology.
Yeah, you know, I feel like the available options for the treatment of Cushing's disease leave room for a novel agent with a mechanism of action like this. I would say the efficacy related to safety risks, that balance is not optimal in the existing drugs, including the drugs that have been around for decades. And so it's just difficult to use those drugs long-term in patients who need pharmacologic control of their hypercortisolism. So, I mean, it's, of course, very hard to extrapolate results from a single dose of a novel compound, but if these results hold up with multiple dosing and in the patient population, I would predict that this mechanism would compare favorably to the other options for the treatment of Cushing's.
Yeah, and if I can just add to it, you know, before we started this program, because of paltusotine and our longstanding involvement in endocrinology, we've been talking to leading endocrinology researchers around the globe for, in my case, decades. And whenever we ask them, especially the neuroendocrinologists that manage acromegaly as well, whenever we ask them what they really need the most, Cushing's is almost always at the top of the list. And so, you know, from that community, we decided to start this program, that community input, we decided to start this program really figuring that the discovery effort was almost impossible. We were unlikely to get there. But we were really happy that the discovery started finding these agents very quickly, and then we optimized it into one with good drug-like characteristics And so this is really a step forward for the field that I think is really almost historic in terms of the novelty of the approach, and certainly for the company. So, there's no other agent out there that we're aware of that can also do ACTH antagonism. So it's really something brand new and exciting for the field.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. I will now turn the call back to our speakers.
Well, I'd just like to thank everybody for participating in today's call. And once again, congratulations to the team that made this happen. Thank you very much.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.